You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
Atomic Insights.
Good evening, Shane, and it's time for show number 7 of the Atomic Show.
Awesome.
This is Rod Adams coming to you from Annapolis, Maryland.
And this is Shane Brown coming to you from Albuquerque, or I should say Los Lunas, New Mexico, since I actually live south of Albuquerque now.
Oh, that's right. You did move to a longer commute.
Longer commute, and I'm experimenting with vanpooling. And there's a group at a place where I work which runs a vanpool with about 15 people. And to fight the rising cost of fuel and the fact that I drive a vehicle that only gets 25 miles to the gallon as opposed to the 50 I would like to get with a diesel, I've decided to save some wear and tear on the vehicle, get up a half an hour earlier every day, and take the van in to work with 10 other similarly minded people. So,
yeah, that also,
so far it's working pretty well.
That also gives you the opportunity to do a little dozing or maybe read a newspaper while you're on your way to work.
Absolutely. So, well,
I imagine that the vanpool, if it's anything like those in this area, has certain rules about quiet on the way into work.
I have noticed that it is distinctly silent on the van in the morning, although Friday morning or the other morning I managed to get myself right in between a conversation with the two of the most loquacious of the vanpool's participants, and being as the caffeine hadn't really kicked in yet, I was dozing through half of the conversation, and then I'd pipe up with something when they were talking about something interested, and then went back to sleep.
All right. Well, tonight, folks, Shane and I want to talk to you a little about some pretty exciting news that has transpired in the last week with regard to new nuclear power plants in the U.S. and in other places around the world. So one of the first announcements of strong interest to those of us who are interested in clean, reliable, safe nuclear power is that Duke Power and Southern Company have actually selected their site for the first plant that either one of them has constructed in the past 30 years.
That site is, I believe it's the Cherokee site just outside of Gaffney, South Carolina, isn't it?
That is correct.
And that's not a greenfield site, is it?
I believe that Duke made some site preparations back in the 70s to put a plant there. I'm not sure exactly how far they went.
It's actually interesting. This is what I was mentioning before we started recording. The site preparations they made have actually been seen by millions of people in the form of a movie from 1989 called The Abyss, which has a diver, of course, is on my list of movies to get in the director's cut. Basically, every underwater scene in that movie was filmed in the uncompleted flooded containment for that reactor containment in Gaffney. And they flooded the bottom half of the containment, or however far they got with it, with about 7 million gallons of water, and put a simulated saturation diver's habitat into the bottom of it, which can still be seen there to the present day because 20th Century Fox didn't have the money to remove the prop and the set. And it's interesting to me that they picked this site because they're going to have to go in and clean up all the props. That's not something that's going to happen with every it's just amusing to me.
That is interesting. I had heard a little bit about the Gaffney site speaking with a friend of mine who works for Duke Power and was telling me a little about their site selection process. Of course, he could not reveal any information at the time, but
absolutely
did mention that Gaffney was one of the sites that was being considered because of the same considerations, the same criteria that made it a pretty good site back in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm. excellent local workforce availability, good tax breaks provided, although that's really the case on every new nuclear power plant, greenfield or restarted plant construction that got halted in the 80s or 70s because of the economic climate at the time. I mean, this stuff is built so sturdily. That's just sat there patiently waiting for decades until someone realized, hey, you know, this is a good idea. Why don't we finish it?
Yep. Well, one of the interesting things about the tax breaks that are being offered, in this particular case, the county, Cherokee County, offered Duke and Southern Company a 50% reduction in their property taxes. However, it's probably a really good deal for the county itself, since this plant is going to represent a $4 to $6 billion investment.
Yep.
Now, that's because they are going to build two reactors, not just one.
I can't remember whether they'd started the containments for both reactors or whether there's just the one. I'd have to look at the pictures and look in all my bookmarks to check it out. But I know that at least they have the one containment. So.
Now, do you know anything about the site? Is there cooling water, or will they have to build towers? What's the...
As far as I know, I'd have to go and look. I imagine it's probably going to require cooling towers just as a basis for comparison. Cooling towers seem to be a lot easier to push through given the EPA regulations on discharging warm wastewater into a system, into an environmental system.
Yeah,
a good example of that I've seen, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Go ahead.
A good example of that I've seen is on my trips back and forth between New Mexico and Mississippi, where my family and my wife's family is from. There is a nuclear plant that's right off of I-40, and you can actually see the cooling tower for Arkansas Nuclear 1 Reactor Plant 2. When they built the first plant in the early 70s, they had the site license allowed them to discharge properly treated and properly cooling water back into the Dardanelles Reservoir, which is on the Arkansas River. But when they applied for the second reactor, apparently, that would have put them past their limitations on how much warm water they could discharge into the reservoir, so they built a cooling tower for the second unit.
Interesting. It's one of the interesting things about cooling towers is they are the visible and often repeated symbol for a nuclear power plant, yet the cooling towers used for nuclear power plants are identical to those used in coal-fired power plants that have been built since the concern about thermal pollution came into effect, because the fact of the matter is that both kinds of steam plants need to reject a considerable amount of heat.
On the order of 2/3 of the energy that's generated in either the coal-fired boilers in the coal case or the nuclear-fired boilers in the nuclear case, 2/3 of that energy ends up in the outside environment, and only 1/3 of it ends up in the wires going out to the consumers. And unfortunately, that's a consequence of the second law of thermodynamics, and that's not in any danger of being repealed.
No, that's one of the reasons that over the years the combined cycle plants became quite popular, because without getting too deeply into the laws of thermodynamics, the hotter the starting temperature and the lower the ending temperature, the more efficient you can make a heat engine system. And the combined cycle gas turbine plants allow you to have a very high starting temperature, get some energy out of it in the first stage by turning a gas turbine, and then the exhaust of the gas turbine is hot enough to run a steam plant. And so you get the second stage of energy production or electricity production. I think the most efficient. Most efficient combined cycle plants, I think, run somewhere close to 60%, 58% or so.
I've heard 50 as a repeated number for just conservative analysis. And the Teller reactor that I mentioned a few shows ago was designed to run with a combined cycle. Unfortunately, the combined cycle that they picked was using helium coolant, which, as you've pointed out, there's not exactly a very large installed base of helium power conversion turbine manufacturers. So that would be a problem that they would have to face.
But, yeah, I went back and looked at that Teller reactor, and there's a lot of things that are very interesting about it, but one of the things that I found out was that they really weren't talking about a very small plant. They were talking about...
A gigawatt.
Yeah, that's 1,000 megawatts. That's basically a standard size for a nuclear power plant.
And really, to justify digging a hole and putting something in that hole for all eternity, a reactor plant that would be its own waste receptacle at the end of its operating lifetime, I think that's what drove them to pick such a large plant size, is to justify the cost of excavating the hole, which would be a cube on the order of about a football field in length, but 100 yards on a side cube filled with sand with the reactor in the center. So that would be completely decoupled from any seismic disturbances and things of that nature.
That's a really big hole.
Yes.
But
yes, it is.
Actually, not anything that's really terribly unusual when you consider some of the foundations and underground parking garages and stuff that are built in many cities that cover a full city block.
Not to mention the scale of the kinds of excavations that go on in coal mines.
Or, quite honestly, uranium mines, for that matter.
Although, thankfully, uranium is one of you can't exactly leach coal out of the ground as a liquid and then convert it back into a solid.
No, there's not really anything such as in situ coal mining.
Well, I've actually heard of a technology. I can't remember where it was, where they were talking about drilling some wells down into a coal seam and injecting oxygen and superheated steam from a nuclear power plant and reforming the coal in situ into methanol or methane without having to bring the coal with the ashes to the surface. You'd inject nuclear heated water down and get synthetic fuel up the other pipeline.
Amazing. All kinds of creative ways to come up with to pull the fossil fuels out of the ground. Let's go back on to some more interesting new nuclear power news. I also ran across an article in a South Korean publication that indicated that South Korea is pretty excited about prospects for building even more nuclear power plants. Right now, South Korea receives about 40% of its electricity from, I believe, something on the order of 20 plants. Let me see if I can find this number here.
And what's interesting is that, as far as I remember, four of those plants were actually bought Canadian technology as CANDU technology. So there's an interesting synergy there that Jeremy Whitlock over on the Canadian Nuclear FAQ, the FAQ, has written about, where they're talking about being able to run spent pressurized water reactor, PWR fuel, from the balance of 16 plants out of that 20 that aren't CANDU, being able to run that spent fuel through the CANDU plants because of the much higher neutron efficiency of CANDU plants. CANDU plants can actually burn what is called quote-unquote spent PWR fuel without any reprocessing other than just breaking apart the old fuel pins and reforming them into the different form factor that the CANDU plants need. I think the process is called DUPIC, D-U-P-I-C, and if you do a Google search on it, you can find all kinds of neat papers on it.
Yeah, I think I've read something about that. Maybe, I mean, I probably saw it in Jeremy Whitlock's FAQs. When you take a look at what the enrichment is of the fuel that we remove from our pressurized water reactors, if the number that sticks in my mind is it's still
about 0.9.
Yeah, there you go, 0.9%. So that's higher than natural uranium, which is the normal fuel source for a CANDU reactor.
Yep. It's neat that we already have technology in hand for recycling fuel as is with no capital investment. And I often thought about this. I had this idea that I hatched a few years ago, and I was just figuring up, you know, what would happen if you've heard of the nuclear plants that the Canadians have been talking about putting in to provide steam for reforming tar sands up in Alberta into synthetic crude oil, right?
Sure. Yeah, they're having some real difficulties with their economics of the tar sands because
they're using
natural gas they're using is becoming more valuable as a product rather than being used in the processing.
Wouldn't it be interesting if they were to use the Dupic process to take spent fuel from pressurized water reactors to run the CANDUs to extract that oil and then ship that oil back down to their southerly neighbor?
It's getting to be an interesting cycle. That's almost as much a recycling interest as my father's old recycling process at the house.
Lots of compost piles.
Yeah, Dad had a compost pile, but he decided that compost wasn't quite efficient enough and didn't provide the kind of fertilizer he liked for his fruit trees, so he bought some rabbits and had the rabbits eat the leftovers from peeling fruit and all that kind of stuff, and then took the rabbit leftovers and gave that to the fruit trees.
Reminds me of a scheme that got hatched, or quote-unquote, by a friend of my wife's grandfather back in Mississippi. It turns out that chickens do not digest very efficiently the feed that they consume. And it turns out that I think it's either chicken feed once used can be used as cattle feed or vice versa. Because one of the two animals isn't very efficient and the other one is quite efficient. So you basically take the output stream from the one animal and connect it to the input stream of the other animal because, well, they don't care what they eat, really, so long as it's nutritious and it provides energy.
But, you know, I think I care what they eat.
Yeah, that's the same reason why I have reservations about the Chinese practice of using untreated human waste as fertilizer.
Yeah, I prefer the mill organite method of using human waste if you need to use it.
That's the process where you sterilize it in some way?
Yeah, if I remember correctly, the story, and maybe it's been a long time, but the city of Milwaukee actually had a process in their sewage treatment plant that heated up the sewage to the point where it was sterile, and then they formed it into pellets and sold it as a product called mill organite.
There's another process I'd heard of. It's a little bit more energy intensive than that. It was developed by NASA. It was a NASA technology that was being considered in the 70s when they were looking at how to recycle organics in a space environment when you have very abundant energy but very limited material resources. And the process they came up with was something called supercritical water oxidation, where basically you take advantage of the fact that water has a triple point, where it has the properties of solid, liquid, or liquid and gas, a double point in this case, at about 900 PSI, or 900 degrees Celsius, about 1800 degrees Fahrenheit, and something like 400 atmospheres. If you were to put untreated waste under those conditions and then inject oxygen, it causes all of the organics to oxidize almost instantly. And what comes out the other side is sterile water and white powdered fertilizer.
So the astronauts would be able to recycle the quote organics.
Yes, and have very sterile organics.
Yeah, one of the most limiting materials you can take into space is water.
Yep.
Water
is exceptionally heavy, which is the reason why the moon is so interesting, because the moon is 40% oxygen by weight. And if you could provide a way of breaking the oxygen out of the rocks, then that oxygen, which comprises 88% of the weight of water, is almost 22 times less expensive in energy to lift that oxygen from the moon than it is to lift it as part of water from the Earth.
Something I never really thought of. Well, here's another country that has decided that they really want to build some new nuclear power plants, and this is a name that might surprise people, and it's Bulgaria. Bulgaria actually has quite a bit of nuclear power right now, but as a result of its agreements with the European Commission, or it is going to have to shut down two of its operating reactors, I believe, in 2009.
Were those reactors of Soviet design?
Oh, yes. They were of Soviet design. Actually, I'm sorry. They're going to have to shut down those two reactors by the end of this year to meet their obligations. And, of course, the design that they used was the RBMK, made famous.
Chernobyl.
Yes, exactly.
The reactor where you put the reactor into a certain state and hit the brakes, it switched the accelerator and the brakes.
Well, it's not quite that easy. There's been an awful lot of stories written about that Chernobyl reactor that are a little bit exaggerated, shall we say.
That's not surprising, and that's the reason why I prefaced it with special conditions. But might be the understatement of the year.
The special conditions that were required to make the Chernobyl reactor go boom, first of all, can be avoided very easily, and all of the RBMKs that remain in operation today have had a significant number of safety upgrades that has made that already rare and very special condition even more difficult to get to, even on purpose. So I personally don't have any strong feelings that these operating reactors that are producing, in some cases, and I guess in the case of Lithuania, as much as 80% of the electrical power for a country, I have no understanding of why they are being forced to shut down in a period where natural gas and coal are difficult to come by in those areas.
Well, people, it seems to me that in the case of certain technologies where you have a very publicly visible accident, it seems to be in the interest of the regulating agencies involved that that accident be made to never happen again. And the best way to do that from the regulatory standpoint is to eliminate the plants rather than rely on a modification of operating procedure, which is the simpler and much cheaper way, speaking from a pure capital point of view. I mean, if you have something that's working and you know that if you do two backflips, a triple axle, and spin a black cat in one arm in order to make the plant blow up, you just make sure you don't hire any acrobats.
Well, or we could say even more simply, my dad was a fan of Hee Haw, and he said this little skit that went on a regular basis where somebody would say to a doctor, "Dog, it hurts when I do this."
Don't do that.
Exactly. And, you know, as
it feels so good when you stop hitting yourself in the head with a hammer.
That's right. As we get closer and closer to the 20th anniversary of the Chernobyl accident, which is about a month and a week away, we'll probably do some more detailed discussion about exactly what happened and how many very special decisions had to be made to force that plant into a situation where it would explode. So that's something to look forward to as we go along.
Absolutely.
But here's another, you've mentioned it, and I've mentioned in my blog before, the Smoking Gun series, which is where I try to find examples of people who come right out and say that the reason that they don't like nuclear power is because they do like something like coal, oil, or natural gas. And I just posted my most recent one today.
I saw that pop up in my RSS feed in Safari tonight. So.
Oh, by the way, folks, I'll take this opportunity to, again, mention the location of our various blogs and publications. There is the Atomic Insights website at atomicinsights.com. There is the Atomic Insights blog at atomicinsights.blogspot.com. And now there's the blog associated with this show, The Atomic Show, which is found at http://atomic.thepodcastnetwork.com. And anyway, here's the article that I found. It was published March 16th, and it's talking about the opposition of Premier Peter Beattie from Queensland, Australia. And Premier Beattie has been had some people from the uranium and the coal industry tell him that uranium and coal can coexist, that both of them are good potential industries for Queensland, and the state government should reconsider its opposition to the uranium industry. And here's Mr. Beattie's quote. He says, "If power is being generated by uranium, we don't need enough coal. I mean, this is black and white. I'm a strong supporter of the coal industry. I'm a strong supporter of clean coal technology, and I do not support the uranium industry because it will be a competing energy source."
Well, leaving aside all discussion of the superiority of uranium to coal and the fact that uranium has more energy in it than the uranium, or put another way, there are actually uranium impurities in coal on the order of parts per million. I think it's 2 or 3 parts per million of uranium and thorium, respectively. Those impurities have more energy in them than the coal that contains them.
Yep. Well, it's pretty straight math. The uranium has something like 3 million times as much energy as coal. So if you have 3 parts per million of uranium in coal, you have about 9 times as much energy in the uranium as you do in the coal.
Yep.
My math is correct.
That sounds right, actually. And another interesting is that uranium is also dissolved in seawater in quantities sufficient that if you were to separate out the uranium from the amount of uranium dissolved in a given volume of seawater, the energy in that uranium is sufficient to desalinate the seawater.
Interesting.
So, but to get back to my point about Beattie's comments about coal, he seems to be missing the fact that capitalism doesn't work by abandoning billion-dollar plants overnight because of the superiority of something else. This is not a zero-sum game, and as you've mentioned, just because uranium is being produced in the same country as coal, it does not mean that one of them is going to automatically spell the doom of the other overnight or even over a course of decades.
That's absolutely true, especially since the coal industry in Australia is very well positioned for supplying a very rapidly growing market in Asia.
China being the principal component, or outside of China, since China has pretty sizable coal reserves, as I remember.
Well, China does have very sizable coal reserves. However, the coal in Australia is more conveniently located for the power demand centers in China than is the coal that's in the upper plains in China. It's easier to load the coal onto ships and ship it over to the ports in China than it is to try to build railroads.
Ships never cease to amaze me at how little energy it requires to move many, 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 many thousands to hundreds of thousands of tons of material. And this was brought home to me viscerally when I was sitting on the gunnels of a liveaboard that was leaving Los Angeles that night, and I was just sitting on the gunnels and had my hand, one hand on the gunnel and one hand on the dock, and the ship was just this boat, 100-foot boat, well over 500 or 600 tons displacement easily. And I remember being able to put my hand out and put it on the dock and push down, and I could feel the boat move as I pushed down on the dock. I could make the boat move about a centimeter. It just amazed me that I was able to move the boat that much, given how huge it was, because, well, boats are weightless.
Yes. Well, it's interesting when you take a look at some of the size of the ships that ply the oceans, particularly those that are carrying cargo where time is not really all that important. And you look at the size of the ship compared to the size of the engine. So pretty impressive, efficient movement. And again, the other advantage of ocean transport is that somebody else has already built you the path. You don't have to build the tracks like you do with a railroad.
Not to mention the fact that the tracks are self-repairing.
Yeah, waves come and go.
But and it would be great. I mean, I've seen this mentioned time and again, but every time I look at the Arctic, I think of the Arctic not as Arctic wasteland, but as future Great Circle path between Europe and Asia, and not by icebreaker.
Well, you know, unfortunately, there is not in the too distant future. It looks like the Northwest Passage may be open year-round.
Been seeing that, and also been seeing a lot of disturbing news about the fact that polar bears are being left to starve because the sea ice melts too soon and comes back early enough, or the sea ice is not around near as long to allow them to build up their stores of fat for the summer, so they're going ashore in northern Canada, and because they're built to hunt seals, they're going and trying to get out to the sea ice, and either drowning, trying to find sea ice to hunt from, or they are starving to death and attacking people. Well, polar bears attack people anyway. I mean, they are white land sharks as far as most people know. But it's kind of concerning that the largest land predator in North America is having trouble making ends meet because of the fact that the platform they hunt from is disappearing from underfoot.
That is a problem. I don't like the idea of the ice melting. I don't know how much of it is caused by humans, but I certainly am not sanguine about it, particularly since I believe that there is a viable alternative that is not only somewhat competitive, it's extremely competitive with the existing fossil fuel sources.
You just have to level the playing field.
We don't even really need a level playing field. We just need one that's not too badly.
Reduce it from a vertical wall to something that's at least on a non-infinite slope.
Yeah. Of course, I do have to, you know, bring ourselves back down to earth, because one of the other things I came across, not surprisingly enough, was an article from the organization called Public Citizen, in which they were quite strongly opposed to Duke Power's announcement and thought that it was quite a subsidy for the fact that the U.S. government is going to help Duke pay its application fee for obtaining its license. Right now, the way that the applications work for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is that the applicant has to pay the Nuclear Regulatory Commission about $250,000 fee plus
application fee plus bureaucrat hour costs.
Right, plus $207 per bureaucrat hour to review the license application.
Has that number been going up continuously over the last 5 years?
Oh, absolutely. It's indexed for inflation. So it goes up at about 4% a year.
That's a fair number. That's enough to double it in less than 20 years.
Oh, yeah. Right now, the estimate from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is if you are applying for a combined operating license with using a design that is already licensed, like the Westinghouse AP600, which is Duke's choice, the applicant can expect to pay about $45 million to the U.S. government for the privilege of having them review the application for that combined operating license.
Yeah, but the upside is that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, as well as the FAA, are two of the government agencies I can think of that do their jobs very, very, very well and very, very, very thoroughly. I can think of a lot of other government agencies in which waste and fraud is probably a lot more rampant than it is in those agencies.
Oh, I have no disagreement with that statement. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is an extremely professional organization that does things on schedule, and if they give you a time estimate, you can be pretty assured that they're going to meet that time estimate, as long as it's something within their control.
Yep.
I have no doubt that they are very knowledgeable and professional. I know a number of folks that are employed at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and I have a great deal of respect for them. I just don't like the way the user fees are structured.
Yeah.
I think that having to pay all the money up front essentially is a huge
barrier to entry
into the regulated nuclear market. Of course, and I definitely don't think that there should be any way to get into the nuclear market without being regulated.
Right. But that said, the regulations seem to have been written with the implicit assumption that 1950s steam technology is the end all and be all, and we need not worry about any future technology.
Well, actually, the regulations have provisions for new technologies. It's just that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is more familiar with one technology.
Yeah. Not just my natural optimism is bleeding through.
Well, you know, it's okay to be optimistic. Well, we've been going for about 37 minutes, and I think we have shown that there are plenty of people who are interested in building new nuclear power plants. And, oh, by the way, for those people who are adamantly believers in the fact that Wall Street does not like new nuclear power plant announcements.
Hello, Dr. Robbins.
Both Duke Power and Southern Company's stock went up on the day they made the announcement that they're going to build a new nuclear power plant in South Carolina, and their stock has remained at the same level as it was on that day. So, so far, so good. I think that people on Wall Street are going to continue to recognize that nuclear power has a place, particularly in an era with natural gas prices in excess of $7 per million BTU and oil prices still at $60+ per barrel.
Absolutely. And if we have a minute, I have a postscript to last week's show about enrichment. There
go
is
for
another.
It. I said go for it.
There is another technology that can benefit from the technology of enrichment that has very little to do with nuclear power, but it's something interesting that I've run across. It turns out that there is a way that enrichment can be used to purify silicon, which is composed primarily about 92% of one isotope of silicon, and then the balance of the 8% are the other two isotopes. It turns out that if you were to enhance the percentage of the dominant natural isotope of silicon, you increase the thermal conductivity of that silicon on order of 5 or 6 times, which would have profound ramifications for CPU manufacturers. And I can put my hand on my iMac right now and know that the G5 is is a chip that runs kind of hot. And if it were made out of isotopically pure silicon, purified using the same technology as is used to enrich uranium, my iMac would be a whole lot cooler, and we might actually be able to get to G6 technology without having made the jump to Intel.
Well, that's a good point. And one more little point. And by the way, that the discussions about enrichment and whether or not certain countries should have access to that or have the ability to build their own enrichment facilities has generated quite a buzz on the blog and on the blog associated with the podcast. So for those of you who have comments about it, please come and visit and share your thoughts. My basic thought is I don't see any alternative to allowing a country who has the resources to do it already and has their own uranium and has their own scientists. I don't see how I can stop them. I don't see how the U.S. can stop them. So maybe somebody's got a better idea, but I certainly don't like any ideas of attacking a country with 5 million barrels worth of oil being produced every day and a population of 70 million people. So anyway, that's my thought, and I'll stick to it, unless somebody convinces me different.
Okay. Well, with that, I think we've come to the end of the show.
All right, folks. Goodbye. Take care. Have a good week. Think atomic.
Absolutely. Night.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
Atomic Insights.